Good morning. Today is the fifth and final part of this series I've been working through with you on the cross of Christ, but I hope and pray it is not the end of the importance and significance of the cross in our life. I hope the cross is not done with us yet, and I hope we're not done with the cross either. I hope that the doctrine of the cross looms large in all that we do from this time forward. I hope that you have heard the message of the cross, that it is a way of life, that it is the meaning of our discipleship, not just the means of our salvation, but rather the whole life of Christianity. I hope that you've heard that and have determined to respond to that message. You cannot pass by the cross without a response. You will respond. You do respond. To do nothing is a response. To turn away from it and look aside is a response. There is no way to see the cross for what it is and not have some response. It could be that your response will be a quiet one, one that I'll never know about. Maybe nobody but you knows about. Between you and your God, a determination to make a change or the actuality of that change itself in your life. It may be something more public. Maybe you need to make amends to people you have wronged. Maybe you need to do something in relationship to us as a church family. The practice of baptism is a 2,000-year-old response to the cross and the doctrine of the resurrection. We're going to have some opportunities to emphasize that in the coming weeks. No time is a bad time to be baptized, but we're going to take some extra time in the coming weeks to emphasize it, with Easter coming up. After we have our Easter Sunday morning service that'll be fun and full of eggs and candy and all that Sunday morning, that evening as well, we're having our Restore service down at the FLC, and we'll have the baptistry out and full of at least mildly warm water, and there'll be an opportunity there if you'd like to put on Christ in baptism. That'll be offered at that time. 2 weeks after that, we're going to have Focus Sunday, which has become, this will be our third one. It's become something we do annually, which is just an opportunity to set forward baptism in a special way of its significance, and to open up that opportunity to say it's here front and center if you'd like to partake. If you needed a nudge in that direction, this is your hint. That day is coming up, and I'd love to talk to anyone interested in being baptized that day or any other day. Those options for response are there. They're big and public. Others are quiet. But you're going to have to do something with the cross of Christ. You cannot read the story of Jesus without being told that you have to do something with the cross. Today we're going to read it from John's Gospel, but every time you pick up the book of Matthew and you're going to read this message: if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. You say, well, I don't like that gospel. That demands too much of me. So you set it aside and say, I'll read Mark's Gospel. And he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. You say, oh, Mark's demanding too, so I'll try Luke. And you read Luke's gospel, and Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. He even adds the word daily just to make sure you caught it. There's no way to read the story of Christ and not see the demand that the cross puts on you. However, it is possible perhaps to miss what Christ has done in the cross and how he has led us through its meaning. And what I mean by that is, in my very first couple of years in ministry, I was at a small church in east side of Midwest City, out east of Tinker, actually. And a young man came to my house that was a child of one of the folks that attended church there. He's a teenage boy, good kid. And he came to my house and he said, I got a question. Oh, great. This is what ministry is all about, right? People show up at your house and have questions and want to sit in your living room. And I think it's probably only happened twice in the whole rest of the years I did ministry. But that night was great. Somebody showed up and had a Bible question. I thought, this is great. And his question was based on something his parents had said. His parents had said, you know, the cross, basically they told him what I've been saying in the sermon series. The cross demands self-sacrifice. It teaches us selflessness. It teaches us to give up and to obey and to follow God in humility. And his question, which when you hear it, don't get mad or anything, but it was from an honest place, but also from a cynical place. His question was, is that actually true? Is that actually what Jesus did? And his point was, from a cynical point of view, a well-intended cynical point of view, doesn't Jesus come out okay? Jesus seems to make a lot of demands, but if you tell that story a little more cynically, okay, and I'll do it just for a moment for the sake of making the point, Jesus lives a human life. He's not a particularly important person when he's born, but he rises to fame. Yes, at one point he is crucified, he dies, but he spends 3 whole days in the grave. In fact, really not 3 whole days, parts of 3 days in the grave. And then he's raised up from the dead. He doesn't stay dead. And then on top of that, he is given, apparently according to Scripture, a seat at the right hand of the Father and a crown and a name above every name that is named, and he's glorified and made fantastic. He says, Ben, you're telling me, and my parents are telling me, that I need to live an entire life of self-sacrifice, and then I'll die. And I'm not coming back in 3 days. I am coming back potentially some point in the indefinite future, I don't know when, but until then, I'm going to stay dead. And I'm not doing it to get a seat at the right hand of the Father. At best, I get like a tent somewhere in heaven to set up, you know, where I can be there too. He says, by comparison, did Jesus really give up that much compared to what he demands? And I know telling that, some of you are kind of cringing and thinking, that's not the way the story goes. But his point was, does what Jesus accomplished match up with what he demands of us? It seems like Jesus demands a lot. What did he actually have to give up? Was his death a 3-day layover that led to infinite glory, whereas he demands of me a lifetime of self-sacrifice and not an immediate resurrection, but a someday resurrection? How should I understand what Christ himself did at the cross? And I think the misunderstanding in that question, that probably most of us don't misunderstand it in that particular way, but a lot of us do something similar, is that we think of the story of the cross and we only think actually of the second half of the story. For us, the story of Jesus begins with a humble birth, a life as a teacher, his death, and his resurrection. What we might say the human part of the story of Jesus, which for any of us would be the whole story because we're human and that's how the story goes. Well, what I want to suggest to you today, especially when you read John's gospel, that there is so much more to what Jesus does and what he accomplishes at the cross, that what he gives up is so much bigger than we might have guessed. And it compels me to look at my life differently. We're going to look at this from John's gospel. We're going to be in John chapter 12 and then one other chapter briefly. But in John the 12th chapter, we're entering into the last week of the life of Christ. We're getting near to the cross. And Jesus is at this moment as famous as he's ever going to get in his lifetime. Now, among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, Sir, we wish to see Jesus. Philip went and told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. Why do I read that story as the beginning? Because this is Jesus at the height of his fame. That the notoriety of Jesus is so impressive that even outside of the Jewish culture, right, we understand Jesus is essentially a Jewish rabbi. He's a teacher among the Jewish people, and he becomes famous among Jewish people. But at this point in the story, his fame is so much that even outside of Judaism, you have people from the Greek world visiting and saying, we'd like to know who this is. We're curious. Tell us more about this fellow. And there's not obedience to Christ or anything like that, but curiosity from among people outside even the Jewish world. That such is the fame of Christ at this moment. This is the height of his notoriety. And it's at this point that Jesus begins to say out loud some very sobering things. In verse 23, he says, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." His response is not, "Fantastic, things are going well." Instead, it's a cryptic statement that I am about to be glorified. Height of his fame, I'm about to be glorified. Sounds like you're glorified already. Sounds like people are coming from all over to hear you and see you. Sounds like you're famous. He says, that's not what this story is about. What happens next is going to be the glorious objective of his life, not the fame of masses coming to say, show us the spectacle. It's something still to come. After all the wonders, after all the miracles and the fame of Jesus, the pinnacle of his ministry was still just ahead. And he begins to teach his disciples all the things we've been saying in the sermon series. That life doesn't end in death, but rather death is the beginning of still more glorious life. He says in verse 24, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone, but if it dies, it bears much fruit." He says, you think that this is just an upward trajectory and I'm famous and I'll get more famous and then great things are going to happen. He says, that's not how glory happens. He says, good things come, but something a little darker has to happen first. We have to put the seed in the earth. And he talks about his own death by way of metaphor. The glorification of Christ required the journey to the cross. The cross is not an interruption of the purpose and glory and fame of Christ. It is its beginning. Everything else would pale in comparison to what he would accomplish in the days and hours to come. So he's teaching this to his disciples, and he says, "Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servants be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him." Again, I'm just laying some groundwork here. He is simply repeating the doctrine that we've been teaching for this entire series, that the cross is not only something Jesus does for you, it is something he does and draws you to do yourself. My servants will follow me, and where I am, there will my servants be. Where I am, where are they going to see Jesus next? Don't skip a step. I don't think he's saying, I'm going to go to heaven and be with God, and so you can be there too. The next place they're going to see Jesus is on a cross. And he says, where I am, there will my servants be too. There's no shortcut. He's about to show them the road to what follows, but there is no way around the cross. It is part of the journey to arrive at the destination. You have to pass through it. That's the way my servants will go. That's the way we'll do this. He doesn't demand of us anything he himself isn't going to do first. But he does demand of us everything he himself is about to do. And so leading the way, he makes his own journey to the cross. And it's with that groundwork then, he says these words, "Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I have come to this hour." Haunting verse to me. Because you see Jesus, the master teacher, at a loss for words. This is the man who has been debating Pharisees and teachers of the law and Sadducees and hypocrites and everybody else. He's been arguing them to silence. I mean, he is a master rhetorician, an orator. He's a teacher. He's got parables for everything. He's got proverbs for everything. He's got a word and an answer for everything. He's the master teacher. He taught us how to pray. The Lord's Prayer that has survived as the model of prayer for 2,000 years. That's his prayer. And on this occasion, he says, oh, I'm troubled. I'm not sure what I should say. And he's speaking of saying to God. Jesus, who taught us to pray, says, I'm not sure how I should pray today. What should I say? Troubled. Should I say, Father, save me from this hour? What are you taught about prayer? Pour out your desires on God and let him sort them out, right? You desire something, you need something, you want something, you're in need of rescue, whatever it is, you take that to God, you say it out loud, you be honest, you be sincere, and he'll do right by you. Jesus said, if I were to do that right now, what would I say? Please, oh please, don't let me go to a cross. If I were to say that right now, what would I pray? Deliver me from this hour? How can I pray to the Father, save me from having to go to the cross, when I also know that's the reason I'm here? And that's what I've been teaching my disciples all along, that there's a cross for me and there's a cross for them. But now he is at the very brink of it, and he himself describes himself as troubled. There is even an uncertainty in his voice. And I want to say that carefully, because I don't want you to misunderstand and say that Jesus is confused or something like that. Don't take that away from my sermon. He is not uncertain in God. He is not uncertain in right and wrong or morality. He's not uncertain about his purpose. He's not uncertain about what's about to happen. He seems to know all that too well. His uncertainty is, how am I supposed to pray about that? When the thing I would want most is the opposite of what has to happen next. Jesus faces this the way any human faces it. He is not spared any of it. Down through the years, there have been various paintings and illustrations of the crucifixion of Christ. And then in the age of movies, there have been movies about the death of Christ. We put them in, you know, little illustrations and books and things. And the ones that drive me crazy are the ones that show Jesus kind of stoically on the cross, maybe even smiling, just kind of hanging there as if somehow he is untouched and unscathed by crucifixion. That's not the picture that the story tells. On the cross, he is going to experience everything a human would experience on the cross because he's a human on the cross. And leading up to the cross, he experiences every ounce of anxiety, of concern, of dread that any human would experience. More so because for him, there's a certainty in it. His uncertainty has a certainty. We fear what might happen. He knows what must happen. And that's exactly where he's headed next. The journey of Jesus to the cross is no mere pit stop in an otherwise pleasant life. It is every inch and every ounce of suffering that any human could experience. And I want to suggest to you even more. He looks up at the sky, not knowing, as he says, what I should say next. He says, I'm not sure what I should pray for. And so he determines instead to pray this prayer, Father, glorify your name. What does that mean? God, you do the thing that has to be done that gets you glory. And when he says that, a voice comes from heaven, I have glorified it and will glorify it again. It is as if he is asking for some bit of reassurance and also at the same time offering complete submission to the will of God. And God responds, and says, that's exactly what's going to happen. He does not offer any excuse from the pain. The Father does not shout from heaven and say, don't worry, it's not going to be as bad as all that. What do you do when your kids come to you and they're afraid? You tell them it's not as bad as you think. It's not something to worry about. You want to make it all go away. The Son of God prays to God, you do what's best. And the Father simply responds, I will. The crowd hears this and is amazed by it, although they don't understand it. They say, well, we don't know what that was. Was that an angel? They heard it. They said, an angel has spoken to him. But Jesus said, this voice has come for your sake, not mine. Meaning what? Even that moment of reassurance offered to Jesus wasn't for him. Jesus himself is struggling. Jesus himself is troubled. But the voice that sounds from heaven isn't to help him through it. It's to call our attention to what he's accomplishing. Everything that happens in this scene is for us. None of it is for the benefit of Jesus himself. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Is Jesus going to be glorified? He absolutely is. But what will his glorification look like? He will be lifted up, but he will be lifted up on a cross. He will be declared to be a king, but he will be declared to be a king upon a cross. See the problem? He is going to cast out the power of this earth, but it's not for his benefit. He's doing that for us. Every moment of it is actual sacrifice. You understand the difference? You go to work, you work hard, and then you get paid for it. You get compensated with something that matches what you gave up. It's not a sacrifice. You earned that. Jesus is not going about this to get something out of it. It is utterly and completely selfless. The reassurance from heaven is for us. The glorification of Christ is for us. Christ didn't need to be glorified. And that's the key point here. We need Jesus to be glorified. We need the false king of this world to be thrown out. We need evil to be defeated. We need death to be conquered. We need Jesus on the throne. Jesus doesn't need any of that. There is nothing that Jesus gains by the cross that was not already his by right. This is not an exchange for greater glory. This is something that is done entirely for our benefit. And when Jesus had spoken these words, this is a few days later, you can see, but the same story plays out. A few days later, in John 17, he's had the Last Supper with his disciples. He's ready. This is now the evening before the cross itself. And Jesus himself prays. And what does he pray? Father, the hour has come. And it's the same prayer. Glorify your Son, that the Son may glorify you. Even his glory is not for himself. The hour has come. The task is to be finished. But it's not for himself. It is for some other good that he goes to the cross. And then in verse 5, this cryptic statement that I hope sparks your imagination just a little bit today. And now, Father, glorify me in your own presence with the glory that I had with you before the world existed. Ponder that last bit just a little bit. When we tell the story of Jesus, we say he was born, he lived a humble life, he became a famous teacher. He did some miracles. He died, but then God raised him from the dead and he was glorified. But that's only half of the story. If you take the doctrine of God seriously as Christians teach it, if you take the doctrine of the Trinity seriously as Christians teach it, and I'm one who does, then before all that, in eternity unnamed and unnumbered, the eternal Son already is all those things. In eternity without counting, He Himself, eternally begotten, not made, is in the bosom of the Father, sharing in perfect bliss and perfect unity with the Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever. Amen. The unapproachable light of the presence of Father, Son, and Spirit. He is already master of the universe. He is already the agent of creation. He is already being heralded by angels. Do you think He needs our song? In all eternity, angels surround the throne, singing, "Holy, holy, holy, He who was and is to come." He's already worshipped by better people than us. Do you think He needed our praise? Do you think He needed a seat at the right hand of the Father? He had to get out of that seat in order to come down here. He says, "I want the glory to be restored," not gained, restored, "that had existed before the world existed." Everything He attains is for our benefit. Everything He had given up, He already had. Everything Jesus gained was already His. So when you consider the earthly component of that, you're just missing half the story. Yes, in some sense, Jesus is a humble man who is exalted by God. But there's a whole other piece of that story. That Jesus is God Himself, descended to be with us. Few have dared to imagine that. If you read, go back in high school English maybe, you might have been forced to read a chapter or two out of Paradise Lost from John Milton a few centuries ago. Milton tried to imagine in poetry what that scene might have looked like. And it's a captivating, it's all imagination, it's fiction, but you know, it's Christian fiction, so it counts. It's a magnificent story. And in the story, if you read it through, there's this scene where before Adam and Eve fall to sin, Satan is making his way there. And God sees it, because God knows all. And God the Father is on His throne, and He sees Satan making his way to the garden, ready to take on the form of a serpent. And He sees what will happen. He knows what Adam and Eve will choose. He knows what that will cost Him. And the scene is set in heaven, and the angels are surrounding, and they're singing. You know, it's just a nonstop worship service, and they're singing, and God says out loud what's about to happen. The Father says, "There goes the serpent. Here comes the temptation. Adam and Eve will fall. And then these creatures whom I love, whom I have made to my glory, my workmanship, my craftsmanship, my children, then because of my word, because of my justice, will deserve death. And I will have to give it to them." And then He says, the only way to avoid that would be if someone would take their place. And for the first time in the epic poem, heaven goes silent. Because no angel wanted Him to think they were volunteering. No one steps forward. No one moves a muscle. Everyone is silent. Until from the very side of God, the Son Himself responds, "Behold me then, me for Him, life for life I offer. On me let thine anger fall, account me man. I for His sake will leave thy bosom and this glory next to thee freely put off, and for Him lastly die well pleased. On me let death wreak all his rage." The Son offers what no other would. This is Milton's imagination. I don't know how that scene went down. But the point of it is absolutely what John is trying to tell us. That Jesus in eternal glory determines to do something for us that benefited Him not at all. What did Jesus leave at the cross? Only everything. He left it long before that. He left it to be born. He left it to live among us. small, smelly creatures that he had made who have rebelled against him every day of our lives, he came to live among us and gave up glory. And then to die on our behalf. What did he leave at the cross? Only everything. And that's why he does not hesitate to tell us the same is demanded of us. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him, by the way, not his joy, he already had joy, for the joy set before him is yours. In order to bring you joy, the offer of bringing joy to you, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and is again seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted in your struggle against sin. You have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. The Christ who gave up all has demanded by comparison of us so little. For our benefit, he suffered. For our benefit, he lived again. For our benefit, he is glorified. He gained nothing but us. And we ask what we have to give. The fact is, and we've been singing it all month long, and I hope we've caught the message. Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small.